Good afternoon. I am Marilyn Serafini with the Alliance for Health Reform. And on behalf of our honorary co-chairmen, Senators Cardin and Blunt, I would like to welcome you to today's briefing on the subject of healthcare costs. I would also like to thank our partner in this briefing, the Kaiser Family Foundation. And we have with us today as my co-moderator, Drew Altman, who is the founder of the Kaiser Family Foundation. So our mission today is to try to take some of the mystery out of healthcare costs. Our experts are going to explain the trends, the prospects moving forward, what is driving healthcare costs, and what policymakers and the healthcare community are already doing to try and help keep costs down. So a couple of housekeeping matters. First, we are covered live on C-SPAN today. If you are watching on C-SPAN, you are welcome to also follow us on Twitter. We will be live tweeting with the hashtag HCCosts. If you are watching on C-SPAN, we invite you to submit questions via Twitter, again, using that hashtag HCCosts. I would also like to note that you have a blue evaluation form in your packet before the end of the briefing today, if you could kindly fill that out. If you are a congressional staffer, you also received on the way in a yellow survey. We would be extremely grateful if you could fill that out and give it to one of our staff members on your way out. That will help us to know what your interests are and to help us do a better job in putting on these briefings. So I'd like to introduce our panelists today. First, to my far right, we have Gary Claxton. He's a vice president of the Kaiser Family Foundation and the director of its healthcare marketplace project. Gary today is going to explain the healthcare cost trend and what we can expect moving forward. To my left is Joe Antos. He's the Wilson H. Taylor Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at the American Enterprise Institute. Joe is going to help us understand what factors are driving healthcare costs. To my far left is Jeff Selberg. He's the executive director of the Peterson Center on Healthcare. Jeff is going to address the various programs and approaches that are already underway and the strategies to keeping healthcare costs at a manageable level. And to my right, I have already introduced somewhat my co-moderator, the founder of the Kaiser Family Foundation. He is a member of the Institute of Medicine and was commissioner of the Department of Human Services for New Jersey. He was director of Health and Human Services at Pew Charitable Trusts and also vice president of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And Drew also served in the Carter administration. So Drew is going to start us off by giving us some perspective on the issue of healthcare costs. By coincidence, he has a column in today's Wall Street Journal on the subject, and you also received a copy of that on your way in. So I'm going to turn it over to Drew.
Some of you remember the Carter administration, right? It's great to see so many of you here. I just have to say a word about Marilyn. I started working with Marilyn when she was at the National Journal asking me hard questions a lot of the time, and then she worked with us at Kaiser Health News, and I got to ask her some hard questions sometimes, and now we're working together at the Alliance. It's just great to be working with you again. And it's amazing to see so many of you here. Thank you for being so interested in this topic. I actually started studying the problem of healthcare costs a long time ago when I was at MIT, sometime between the passage of Medicare and Medicaid and when you were all born, just looking at the audience. And it's kind of tempting for me to say I feel a little bit like a football coach. You've seen all the plays and all the formations and even the trick formations from my New England Patriots before, and there's nothing new. But actually, that's not true. We're at kind of a different point when there's a lot that's new about the problem of healthcare costs. There are some pretty big questions about where health spending is headed. So I actually think it's a very timely briefing. You know, the Alliance always gets it exactly right. In 2002, I published, let's see if this works. Yeah, I published this chart in Health Affairs. It was a one-page article, and the title was "The Sad History of Healthcare Costs as Told in One Chart." And it documented what since the beginning of time had been the basic dynamic for the problem of healthcare costs. They moderate and then they bounce back with peaks and valleys, which are driven by both changing economic conditions and changes in health policy and changes in the healthcare marketplace, and also just the threat of changes in health policy or impending changes in the marketplace. Now we're coming off of several years of unusual moderation in the rate of increase in health spending. It's really historic, let's call it extreme moderation. It's really historic moderation in the rate of increase in healthcare costs. And Gary's going to show you the data, so I'm not going to do that. But just a couple of big picture points for you to keep in mind. One of them is that there is widespread agreement that the slowdown is due both to the sluggish economy and to changes in the healthcare system, by which we mean changes both in health insurance and in the health delivery system, with the economy being the biggest factor. But there is, how should I put it? I guess I would describe it as modest but not profound disagreement about the relative contribution of each of those factors. And I'm sure Joe and the rest of us will be talking about that today. And since I'm sure you're going to ask, there's far less agreement about the role of the ACA, about the role of the Affordable Care Act, or frankly, whether it has played any role at all. And we will all have views on that. So the big question really is, has the sad history, these peaks and valleys that you see here in the chart, been repealed? Have we somehow boldly gone on healthcare costs where we have never, you know, ever gone before? Is that even plausible to anybody? So we're beginning to see now, just very recently, an uptick again in the rate of increase in spending, which was predicted by most of the models, including our own models at Kaiser. And I think the question really to keep in mind is not whether health spending grows more rapidly again, but when and by how much, and is it a lot or is it a little? Here's one thing to keep in mind, and that is that this is a business where small increments really do matter. So think about this rule of thumb. A 1% difference in the rate of increase, so 1% up or down in the rate of increase in health spending, that's $2 trillion over a 10-year period. So a lot of what you do, a lot of what we do in health policy when we work on the problem about of healthcare costs, it's, you know, not the effort to see if we can totally change the healthcare system or cut health spending in half. It's really more the effort to see if through 100 little ways or 50 little ways, we can shave 1% or 0.5% or 0.25% off of what that rate of increase in health spending would otherwise be. Just one other big picture introductory point I wanted to give you. Keep in mind also that this is a multifaceted problem that you need to deal with in your jobs from several different angles. So you also focused a lot on Medicare and Medicaid because they're such a big part of the federal budget, and spending on those problems are affected by a whole bunch of factors which can be different from the factors which drive national health spending. And then just lastly, you also need to deal with healthcare costs from the perspective, right, of constituents and voters. So it's worth pointing out that experts and people, and, you know, in my experience, experts are also people, but maybe not always, view the issue very, very differently, and that's what that Wall Street Journal column you have in your packets I wrote today is about. And it just, this may be obvious, but it's worth saying, it would not be a great idea to tell the average constituent in a town, meaning that they should be grateful because they live in this wonderful period of great moderation in healthcare costs, because they might look at you like you're a little bit crazy. And that's because from their perspective, their premiums are going up, their deductibles especially are going up at a time when their wages are flat. And so the last chart I just wanted to get into your heads shows that. I don't think it could show it any more clearly. This was in 2013, which was a record year for low increases in health spending and healthcare premiums. Just 3% of the American people told us that they thought healthcare costs were going up. slower than usual. So, and I will end with this, kind of my framing for the discussion. The national health spending problem, the health and the federal budget problem, the health costs as a consumer issue problem, these are all related but different dimensions of the overall healthcare health cost problem, which in your jobs you all need to deal with. So as you listen to the briefing this morning, listen for not just one problem, but at least those three problems. With that, I'll turn it over to Gary.
I'm sorry, it's working. Good afternoon, everyone. Let's see if I can. I just have a couple minutes to try to talk to you about healthcare costs, what they are, and how they've been changing over time. So I'll try and do it kind of quickly so we have plenty of time for questions. This first slide shows information on per person spending on healthcare over the last 50 years or so, a little bit longer than that. This information comes from the National Health Accounts, which is sort of the nation's way of keeping track of how much we spend on healthcare. The total, from what you can see from the slide, the total expenditures on healthcare in the U.S. in 2013, which is the last year with final numbers, was $2.9 trillion. And this translates into about $9,300 per person. It also is, the little numbers on the bottom show, it represents a little over 17% of the gross domestic product or sort of national income. Healthcare costs have risen steadily over time from about $1,100 per person in 1980 to almost $4,900 in 2000 to the $9,300 last year or in 2013. They've also have risen faster than other goods and services in the economy. Healthcare represented about 7% of GDP in 1970, 12% in 1990, and as I said, 17% in 2013. While things have slowed recently, as Drew pointed out, the rapid growth in healthcare costs over the previous decades is what really raised policymakers' concerns about the ability to afford and sustain our healthcare system and our healthcare spending over time. And obviously, why we care about healthcare costs, just to say the obvious, is it costs money, obviously, for people to consume healthcare and for governments to support healthcare programs. But also, the more money we spend on healthcare, the less money we have to spend on other things we care about, like education at the state level. This next chart shows how the U.S. healthcare spending compares to that of other nations. And some of it didn't come out very well, but generally, the U.S. spends about $2,600 more per person than the next closest country, which is Switzerland, and about twice the amount per person as sort of the average of other nations, which have large populations and large and high incomes.
And if I can just stop you for just one second, Gary, you have the full graphic, even though it's not showing properly here. You have it in your packets. And if I wanted to also mention that if you're following this briefing at home on C-SPAN, you can look at all of these presentations and other supporting materials at our website, which is www.allhealth.org. Okay, sorry, Gary.
No problem. When you look at the spending in terms of GDP, as I said, the U.S. spends about 17% of our GDP on healthcare. These other countries spend between 9 and 12%, so much, much less. Another dimension of the problem or the issue of healthcare is that different programs, different payers, there's different ways to look at it, and they all have their different political and economic dimensions. I have one example here which shows Medicare spending per enrollee versus private health insurance spending versus per enrollee over a couple of different decades. What you can see from it is that although the growth has been very similar until recently, where Medicare growth has been much lower, Medicare continues to be a much hotter political topic than private health insurance spending. There's a couple reasons probably for this. One is that Medicare is a public program, which is on budget, where private health insurance, while it has a big effect indirectly on the budget, those effects are indirect through the tax system, and so they're not as visible. Another is that Medicare has a demographic issue where the population is aging. There are many more people going onto the program. So even if Medicare spending per enrollee goes up at the same rate as spending in private health insurance or for just the rest of us, the costs of the program are going to grow because there's more people in the program. There's also some issues around the trust fund and the payments for Part A. I didn't want to so much point out the Medicare issues here, although they are important to what you all do, but to point out that each program and each sort of perspective has its own important factors that you need to consider when you look at the healthcare cost issue. We're not even mentioning today the effects of healthcare costs on individuals and their out-of-pocket expenses and their ability to afford their out-of-pocket expenses. And we could do a whole briefing on that. As Drew mentioned, healthcare spending has slowed dramatically recently. This slide shows that the average growth rate of health spending compared to the economy as a whole has been faster for the previous four decades, and sometimes considerably faster, a couple percentage points. Until recently, when really healthcare spending has actually going up slower in the last couple years than the economy. This recent slowdown in healthcare spending, which began, as I think Drew said, in the mid-2000s, but has really accelerated recently into record low spending, has raised the question as to why, what's going on. Some people, including a paper that we wrote at Kaiser with some others, attribute most of the slowdown to the economic downturn that we experienced recently and the slow recovery. That paper shows that the lag growth of GDP is correlated with health spending and is highly predictive and accounted for a substantial share, we think, of this slowdown. Others acknowledge that the economic slowdown had an effect, but they would say that structural changes in the health system, primarily higher cost sharing in insurance policies, but also things like better data systems and payment reforms, played a larger role in slowing the healthcare spending. So why does this matter? As Drew said, because the answer to the debate about why spending has slowed down suggests something about what healthcare costs will be in the future. If the slowdown was primarily caused by the economy, or the slow economy, then healthcare spending should begin to grow again as the economy recovers, and we may see something that looks more like the traditional pattern of healthcare spending greatly, going up much faster. If the structural reforms dominate, we may see a longer period of slow growth. This chart shows both historic, but then the projected spending from the actuaries at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Studies. Their take on going forward is that healthcare costs will rebound as the economy rebounds, but will not go up at the levels that they have gone up in the past. That in general, they're projecting healthcare costs over the next 10 years to go up at the rate of growth of the economy plus about 1.1 percentage points, which is slower than it has gone up historically. And as Drew pointed out, the amount there matters a great deal. If they're wrong by half or one percentage point, you're talking about half a trillion to $1 trillion. So it's meaningful. If I can just make one final point. You may notice that, although they're hard to see on the slides, that a number of the slides that I showed today are attributed to the Peterson-Kaiser Healthcare Tracker, which is a new program that we have with Jeff and the Peterson Center on Healthcare. The tracker is a place where you can find a lot of this type of cost information, but also information on performance measures of healthcare. And just today, we introduced an interactive tool which will allow you to use information from the national health accounts and to draw your own charts and look at healthcare spending for different payers and different periods of time and different programs set your own parameters and look at them in nominal terms and real terms and things like that. So it's pretty good, and we hope you'll go check it out. Thank you.
Fantastic. Can you pass the clicker down? Okay, we're going to turn now to Joe Antos, who's going to talk to us about what is driving healthcare costs.
Thank you. Thank you, Marilyn and Drew, it's a pleasure to be here to talk about this topic. It's always good for people to begin to come to grips with reality about healthcare spending in this country, which is, as Drew said, it's bouncing back up, which is good news and bad news, of course, depending on who you are and how you look at it. Everybody has their favorite slide. Let's see. How do you do it? Oh. Okay, good. So here's one of my favorite slides. This shows health spending growing as a percentage of GDP. It's a lot smoother than the Drew slide, but it basically tells the same story. I will try to describe some of the many factors that people have suggested that have contributed to what really is pretty much a relentless steady growth in healthcare spending over the past 55 years, which is as far back as the data really take us. Why isn't it going forward? Can you help me? Okay. What? I had it backwards. Which end is up? You know, I'm an economist, so that probably tells you something. Okay. Oh, all right. Now, here's Gary's slide, if you wanted to see it. And I want to thank Gary for producing that slide. Since he already talked about it, I can move on. Okay, so it's always good to know what we're buying with our health care dollars. And so this is just a straightforward kind of slide. One of the things that people often say is that health spending has changed. The nature of health spending has changed, that we've moved away from hospitals and we've moved towards outpatient services of all sorts. Turns out that that isn't what the data show. If you go back to 1960, hospital spending as a percentage of national health expenditures was 33%. Now it's 32%. Physician and clinical expenditures basically stayed about 20%. The one interesting part of this chart that really moved around in the last 50 years or so is prescription drugs. If you look at the endpoints, all you see is kind of pretty much the same story. It started at 9.8% of national health spending and in 1960 and is now about 9.3%. But unlike the other major categories of health spending, this is the one category that has really moved around substantially. Prescription drugs dropped as a share of national health spending to about 4.5% by 1981. And then it really didn't begin to grow substantially until the mid-90s. And that is consistent with the technology story in this country, with regard to prescription drugs at least. We saw an explosion of medical innovation that led to tremendous new drugs, statins, for example, being maybe the biggest driver of that. And similarly, in recent years, we've seen that percentage drop off, and precisely because of statins, mainly the big statins dropping off of patent protection, and frankly, a little bit less innovation. Although we're beginning to see some change there. Anyway, the let's see, what do I want to say here? The other thing I wanted to say about this chart is I'm mostly going to be talking about what is the kind of health spending that is covered by health insurance. But you'll note that there is a small but substantial portion of this chart that we're spending on what is essentially long-term care. That's the nursing care facilities and continuing care retirement communities. And that doesn't even include the costs that people incur that don't show up in the national health account. So that's a major factor. I'm not going to try to explain that directly. Okay, so who's paying? This is also good to know who's paying. And you can see that about a third of the spending comes from private health insurance. Medicare and Medicaid account for another third or so. Out of pocket and other sources account for the rest. So let's move on to health spending growth. It, of course, is virtually inevitable that we're going to see health spending grow over time. The factors you all know, it's an aging society. It's an economy that we're fortunate enough to live in a country that has continued to grow. Despite the big recession that we had recently, nonetheless, the economic news here is, I would argue, better here than maybe any other country in the world. And we're living with more chronic disease. That's partly because we're living better, we're eating more, maybe not exercising enough. And we're living longer, which is one of the reasons why chronic disease is a bigger factor. The longer you live, the more likely you are to have a chronic disease. Okay, financing, of course, is a big, big factor. This drives a lot of the spending. The fact that we have health insurance makes it less expensive for people to buy health services. Health insurance is prepayment for, is a combination of prepayment for routine expenses and coverage for unexpected, totally unaffordable costs. But it's that prepayment that's really driving us. And the fact that hospitals and doctors and other providers are assured that the cost will not get in the way of treatment means that essentially they're more free, they feel more free to do the right thing in terms of recommending what could be very expensive care. Obviously, there are very large subsidies. The Medicare and Medicaid programs are heavily subsidized, tax subsidies. Essentially, it's hard to find anybody in this country who doesn't have some part of their health care costs subsidized by the taxpayer. Okay, the way we run the system also drives spending. Fee-for-service payment is a big factor. Fee-for-service promotes the use of more and more expensive services. If you're a physician, say, in a fee-for-service world, if you provide more services, you get more pay. It's very simple. Financial incentives promote innovation as well. There's a yin and yang in all of this. We're spending more money, but we're getting more innovation. But that often adds to spending. Fragmented delivery system. Now, here's a bit of a puzzle. On the one hand, we all say, and I believe this myself, that because we deliver healthcare in a fragmented way, especially because it's mostly fee-for-service, and we're not having this kind of coordinated care that health policy people talk about all the time, that leads to inefficiency, suboptimal care, unnecessary services. We're spending more money and getting less out of it. On the other hand, I wouldn't be an economist if I didn't say, well, consolidation in the local markets must be driving up prices, and that must be in adding to our cost. I'll let you ponder my schizophrenic stance on this. Okay, and then lack of transparency. We've been talking about this a lot lately, but we really don't know what it costs if we're consumers. We really don't know whether the service is good for us. We don't know whether the providers have a good track record, and this also contributes, I think, to the cost. So the question ultimately is there a cure? And I think the real question here is, is the growth in healthcare spending too rapid? I think that's a philosophical question. It's also a financial question, but it's very difficult to say that we need to cure something. Again, it depends on your perspective. If you're looking at it from a federal budget perspective, there's a big issue, especially when you realize that a very large contribution to our national debt is, in fact, caused by health spending. But from a personal standpoint, what I spend, I spend what I think I should spend. At least that's what I think, but I'm not fully informed. So this is a really difficult question. It's a difficult policy question. It's a difficult question for people and their families. Will eliminating waste and efficiency put us on a sustainable path? We talk about this all the time. I would argue no. If you cut out all the waste in the system, you would still have a substantial amount of spending that would still grow. So it's really the question of how much growth do we want? And as I say, this is a difficult question to answer. And I will not plunge into competition, regulation, and consumerism, but that certainly relates to my schizophrenic view on that other slide.
Fantastic, thank you. Before we turn over the mic over to Jeff, I just wanted to remind you that if you would like to follow the conversation on Twitter, the hashtag is HCCosts. And if you would like to submit a question via Twitter, please use that hashtag and we'll pick that up here. After we hear from Jeff, we're going to turn to question and answer period. And while we have mics, two mics in the room where you may ask your questions, we also have cards in your packets that you can write a question on and hold it up, and a member of our staff will come by and get that. Okay, let's turn it over to Jeff, who's going to talk to us about what is happening and what can happen to keep costs down.
Thank you, Marilyn. I'm going to take just a little different tack, but before I do that, I just want to reinforce Gary's comments about the Peterson-Kaiser Health System Performance Tracker. Our intent in our partnership with the Kaiser Family Foundation is to try to show whether or not this most vital of economic sectors, healthcare, is improving in terms of its value proposition. In other words, are we accreting value over time? Are we getting more for the spend, less, or are we in neutral? It's more challenging than you might imagine. While tracking the spend and the components of the spend is challenging enough, identifying the measures to determine what we get for that spend is proving challenging. But we believe over time we'll be able to demonstrate just what this most vital of economic sectors in the U.S. is doing with regard to performance. Different tact. The Institutes of Medicine, I think, has shown that about 30% of all healthcare expenditures do not add to the value of the outcomes intended. Some would classify that as waste. So let's just talk about what that means. 30% waste in a $3 trillion sector is something on the order of $800 billion. What is $800 billion? It's equivalent to what we spend in K through 12 education, all in. It is double what we spend in all of research and development in this country. So it's a very, very big number. Now, one of the ways that the Institutes of Medicine came up with this number is it studied variation in healthcare, variation in quality outcomes, variation in cost. And it found a very high level of variation, not only across the country, but within communities. It also found that cost and quality, frankly, are mutually inclusive. In other words, lower the cost, higher the quality in the outstanding programs that they identify. Now, most of us would lament this variation, this high degree of variation. We see it as a wonderful opportunity to improve because there are the positive variants out there, the exemplars, the less than 5% that are generating the highest quality outcomes at the lowest cost. And our intent in the Peterson Center on Healthcare is to identify those positive variants, those exemplars, validate the work that they're doing by identifying what the active ingredients are that generates that exemplary performance, and then replicate. Replicate on a very controlled basis to really understand if there's causation there in terms of those identified features or ingredients, and then move to replicate on a controlled basis, limited basis, and then a mass basis. And I'll give an example of that in just a moment. Now, I know I'm in the land of policy here, which is foreign territory for me. My background is being out in the field of practice. And I will say that policy is extremely important in this effort to face the issue of improvement in healthcare. Policy, in my mind, creates the conditions under which the field is willing to engage in change, engage in improvement. I found, however, that sometimes you can get so enamored with policy that it's all you come to the belief that it's all you need, that somehow the payment incentives will be aligned, somehow regulations will be aligned, and then the miracle will happen out in the field. We don't believe that. We believe that practice is as important as policy, and that's where we're choosing to focus. Practice in terms of what I just described, identifying the exemplars and then replicating the key features that they have that generate that exemplary performance. I'll say a third element that's critical in this, and that is patience. We found that in integrating patience into the design of these new models is critical if we're going to have that exemplary performance. So it isn't just being designing with the patient in mind, it's designing with the patient involved. So those are the three P's, policy, practice, and patience. So let me give you an example of the work that we're doing, which hopefully will give you just a little bit more of a granular idea of what I'm talking about. We funded research with the Stanford Center for Clinical Excellence Research led by Arnie Milstein. And what Arnie and his team did is identified the exemplars in primary care. The metrics he used were the HEDIS measures, the top quintile, top 20%, and all-in per capita costs, the lower 25%. And he found a little less than 5% of the practices surveyed did both. High quality, low cost. Went out and site visited 11 of those practices and came up with 10 features. 10 features that we believe correlate to that exemplary performance. Now we're in the process of a what we call limited market test with 5 practices to determine if, in fact, these features are the cause of that performance. Replicate those features in those practices. Have a control group to determine, in fact, it is causation. And then really understand what of those features have leverage in terms of improvement. Then go to 30 to 50 practices, replicate, and then go to a mass replication. Now, we don't proclaim to know how to mass replicate, if that's even a phrase, but that's what we are determined to learn, is that approach. We think there's a lot of different approaches in adult education that we can use, whether it's the Khan Academy or language like Rosetta Stone or Pimsleur, and you might think, boy, he's getting pretty far afield here. But there are, I think, non-healthcare approaches that we're going to have to adopt to get to a point where the 5% exemplary performance becomes the 95% standard in the community. I have been challenged on this in the sense that the question's been asked, well, aren't those 5%ers really exemplary in terms of people? Aren't they the geniuses? Aren't they like the great teachers? You can't make a good teacher a great teacher. And we would strongly disagree. What we're finding in these practices is yes, there are great people in those practices, but they've surrounded themselves with systems and processes and other great people that can be replicated. So we have great optimism in moving this sector by engaging in identifying, validating, and replicating those exemplary practices, whether they be in primary care, high-cost, high-need patients, and also advanced illness management. Thank you.
So we're going to start our Q&A session. So if you have a question, please step to the mic or write your question on the card, and we'll have our staff pick it up. In the meantime, I'd like to ask a first question, and we've heard a lot of discussion about moving away from fee-for-service to coordinated care. The healthcare industry, the sector, is moving quite a bit toward value. So how long is this going to take? What is the time frame here, and when are we already seeing some results, and when will we see some significant results? When do we actually turn the major corner here?
Well, okay, I'll go ahead and plunge in. And it takes a while before you really know you have results. So I think to the extent that the Affordable Care Act may have opened some doors, it's way too early to know. It is certainly the case that there's a lot of talk about changing the way healthcare is delivered. But we do go back to some of our favorite examples, Geisinger, for example, the Marshfield Clinic. These are organizations that are very successful, and they didn't get that way overnight. It really has taken them decades, and they're continuing to work on improvement. And I think that's the key here. Don't expect a miracle anytime soon, but let's not stop working at trying to resolve the problems that we know we have so that we can move on to the problems that we don't know we have.
I'd just add a perspective on that. As long as I've been in the field, there were always two schools about how to approach healthcare costs. One came mostly from conservatives who believed in market competition, more skin in the game insurance, prudent purchasing. The other came mostly from liberals who believed in government regulation. Now we're in a slightly different phase where through delivery reform, payment reform, some of the things Jeff was talking about, we're actually trying to get inside the black box of medical practice and change it. There's reason to be very hopeful about that, and Jeff outlined some of those reasons. There's also reason to be skeptical about some of that. Joe talked about consolidation and being schizophrenic about consolidation. Joe also talked about it takes time, and can we get beyond the big integrated healthcare systems to the mainstream healthcare system with some of these reforms? My view of it is, let's not be religious about it. We need evidence. One of the nice things about the Medicare demonstrations is they're all tied to independent, rigorous scientific evaluations, which will give us some actual evidence data about what the results of some of these changes are. But it is a new approach. It is a new approach to, if you look broadly at how we've taken on the problem of healthcare costs over 30 or even 40 years, to how we tackle this.
Just to, Marilyn, if I could, I know you've got a stack of questions there, but I think this is a great demonstration of how this is a two-step process. Value-based payment is, in my estimation, a very good thing. It does provide an incentive, I think, for greater efficiency and effectiveness where, as I think Joe said, fee-for-service is volume-based, greater the volume, greater the revenue, greater the incentive. The fact is, though, that you have to follow up with more effective delivery, more effective practice, or you're not going to get higher quality and lower costs. So all it does is create a condition under which improvement can be incentivized.
Okay, great. If you could please identify yourself.
Thanks, Marilyn. I'm Mike Miller. I'm a health policy communications physician consultant. I've been doing that for about 25, 6, 7 years. Parallel to the change from volume to value, I mean, there's also sort of new initiatives in terms of how healthcare is delivered and what's considered important, particularly more of an emphasis on population health, community-based care, getting care out into the community. And I'm wondering if any of you are familiar with Elizabeth Bradley's work, where she looked at international comparisons of healthcare spending as percentage of GDP, and also looked at what countries spend on social services as a percentage of GDP, and found that when you add the two together, social services and healthcare services, the U.S. came out not way up at the top, but sort of in the middle, consistent with our healthcare outcomes. So I'm wondering if any of you can talk about those social services as an aspect of how we can improve the quality and reduce costs for healthcare, and how social services might be considered as something that healthcare payers can start incorporating into their schema of what they will reward.
Well, I'll start very quickly. There's a lot there in your question. Yes, I am aware of Elizabeth Bradley's work, and some have chosen to respond to it and saying, see, if you combine those two, we're not the highest spender, as if that's a response to the question of cost. If you look at it, look at her work, you'll find that we spend disproportionately on the clinical medical side and much less so on the social service side. And I think what we're finding, especially with high-cost, high-need patients, that the most effective models there, high quality in terms of responsiveness to the patient, living conditions, clinical outcomes at lower costs, effectively integrate social services and the medical model together. And so how does policy then follow that practice to create the conditions under which that can happen? Vexing issues in terms of insurance models, including social services. There have been models that have worked on a per member per month base reimbursement or per capita that say it's still worth our while to provide those social services because they lead to such a reduction of the medical services. So it is, I think, we're right on the frontier of trying to understand how to integrate these different services.
So I'm going to direct this first question to Gary, although others are welcome to chime in. While health spending is at record lows, premiums, while growing more slowly, aren't showing the same historic growth slowdown. Why not?
At least in our employer survey, and premiums have been growing fairly slowly, not quite as slowly as healthcare spending overall. Part of the reason that overall healthcare spending takes into account some of the reductions in public programs that have occurred recently, private health insurance doesn't have quite the same effects. Also, when you look at changes in overall health spending, when people lose health insurance, they actually spend less. That goes into the health accounts. That means there's less healthcare spending overall. But the average premium for the people who have insurance doesn't necessarily go down because some people lose health insurance. So that's a couple reasons. I don't know, Joe may have some others.
But it's been low.
It has been low. It's the way we do our survey, we can't say it's the lowest we've ever seen, but it's really low.
Also, there's a lag in all of this. You can't have the premiums go down until the insurer has actually experienced slowdown in spending. So that's going to take some period of time. I don't want to speculate about how long that would be. But as Drew pointed out in his opening remarks, we seem to be heading back to a more traditional higher rate of growth of spending. So this may be a very temporary phenomenon.
Okay, so we have another question. We have one question from Twitter, and by the way, again, as a reminder, if you want to tweet a question, the hashtag is HCCosts. Should we change the way medical schools educate doctors to perform well in the new delivery models, and how? And I would add to that, nurses and advanced practice nurses in particular are playing a very large role in the new models of care delivery. So should we also change the way that we are educating them?
Well, in a word, yes. I think in Italian you would say assolutamente, just to confirm that. What do they need to change? Well, I would say design is a key issue. Flow of care, integrated, coordinated, team-based care, integrating some of the things we talked about in terms of social services with the medical model, empathy, orientation to the community, population-based, are all elements that I think need to be fully integrated into a medical school curriculum.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about prevention and whether prevention should be at the forefront. If not, why? And also, what is the data behind prevention and whether it saves? And consumer education, of course, is a part of that.
Okay, well, I'll plunge in here. Prevention, it's a nice word. The most effective prevention that anybody can follow is to change their own behavior, to take the advice that we ought to get off of our chairs and start moving around. We ought to get a full night's sleep, and we ought to be nice to our neighbors. Absolutely. Now, the kind of prevention that people usually talk about when they talk about health spending, though, is preventive health services. That's a whole different kettle of fish. Emphasis on services, not necessarily on prevention. And indeed, Louise Russell, about, gee, that must be 25 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, by now has the classic paper that pointed out the obvious, which is that a lot of preventive health services have to do with screening. And fortunately, most of the diseases we screen for, most people don't have them. So if you have a national program to screen everybody for some rare disease, you'll spend a lot of money potentially on screening. To pick up a very few people, there will be, of course, false positives. There will be false negatives. There will be follow-ups. It's a very complicated and difficult subject. So we need to be smart about this. What we need is a health system that thinks sensibly about what prevention is. The slogan is not where it's at. It is, as Jeff has said, it's where the delivery system meets the patient that really matters. But as I say, the principal culprit in this is you and me.
Yeah, you know, I would like to see us maybe shift our nomenclature slightly from prevention to engagement and activation, regardless of where the person is in their health process. I think it's been shown, I think the research is there, that says activated and engaged patients are result in higher quality outcomes at lower costs. And so regardless of where you are in your aging or disease process, by being engaged and activated, you're going to be better off.
So we have already waded into this a little bit, but what about reimbursement for wellness versus, you know, other kinds of care? Should we be doing this? Are we doing this? Is anybody doing this?
Gary, that's a good one for you.
Yeah, Gary, you answer that.
Certainly we see in our employer survey that quite a few employer-based programs have some sort of incentives for people to both assess their own health and their own behaviors and then have some sort of incentives to improve those behaviors. They vary from small incentives to take a health risk assessment and then to maybe enroll in a program to address your weight or your eating or smoking or some other things, to somewhat more aggressive programs where employers collect biometric markers. They get your blood, they get your cholesterol, they get stuff. And in some of those programs, they actually have incentives or even penalties for not having certain health benchmarks that are within norms or within target amounts. And you may or may not get incentives to try to improve. So we have the range of things out there. Whether or not it's a good idea, clearly we have population health problems, and employers are in a position to help influence those. At the same time, you can use these programs to impose much higher individual costs on people who have medical conditions, some of which may not be readily amenable to change. And this can be about employers saving money or insurers saving money, or it could be about trying to improve population health or some combination of those two things, and sort of how they're implemented really will say a lot about probably their future.
Just a footnote on that, there are some court cases now on this exact point.
There's some privacy concerns, and people obviously are concerned about some of the very intimate questions that are included on the health risk assessment or about some of the information that they're being asked to give their employer and when they're being asked to do it. So it's been going on a few years, but as the programs evolve, we're going to have a lot more discussion about all this.
Okay, we have a couple of questions for Jeff on this. They have lots of interest in the exemplary practices of the 5%. So first, let's start with the first one, and that is, could you give some very specific examples of what these practices are that we should be watching?
Well, I tried to give the example of the Stanford research that the Peterson Center on Healthcare is funding. So let me stay there. We also are working with them to identify exemplary practices in specialty care hospital care, and we're also working with another set of grantees on high-need, high-cost patients. So in the case of primary care, perhaps I could just very briefly go into the 10 features, not all the 10, but the features that the Stanford group found. And what they found basically was an organization, a practice organized around the patient. So it wasn't just the physician. It was a nurse practitioner, physician assistant, nurses, coaches, working as a team on behalf of the patient, knowing the patient's circumstance, life circumstance, as well as their clinical condition. So I'd like to depict that as not only knowing what was the matter with them clinically, but what mattered to them, which is different. And then always being available 24/7, having the systems to always be available to the patient, and having an attitude or a culture that said, we will always be responsible for the patient regardless of where they are in the system. So if they're in the emergency department, we're still responsible for them. If they're in with a referral with a specialist, we'll still be responsible for them. And you could say, well, my goodness, how do they do this? My primary care physician can barely keep up with an 8-minute visit with me, much less all the things that you're talking about. Again, a systems approach, a team approach, good solid information in terms of a medical record, good solid relationships with other components in the system. So there's an example.
So let's take that one step further and talk about mass replication, because you said it's possible.
Yes.
So tell us how it is possible and what needs to happen to achieve success.
Well, that's what we're working on. Quite honestly, we're looking for help in this particular area. We know that how to go into a limited market test to replicate, to really make sure that we're right about what these features can do. We believe we know how to replicate to practices of 30 to 50 practices at that level. The challenge that we have is when you go to the level of 200,000 primary care physicians across the country, and is that going to be done in increments of 30 to 50 practices in what we call collaboratives, or are there digital approaches and adult education approaches that I talked about that we can utilize? That's what we're going to test to find out. And if there's anyone out there that would like to collaborate with us in the learning, we are very open to that.
Okay, so we had another question that has to do with nationalizing an approach, and that has to do with accountable care organizations. So the question is, can you nationalize ACOs with all of the variation that's going on? And ACOs are held out as a means of you know, leading toward value-based care, coordinated care, and with the hope that they will bring down costs and improve quality.
Well, there are a whole bunch of different types of ACOs. That's the first little issue. So when you talk about, I don't want to use the word nationalize, when you talk about spreading them widely, you have to be careful about what you're defining. It is certainly the case that there are things that are called ACOs that have nothing to do with the Medicare program. Why? Well, because it's a great phrase. We have to be with it in health policy. So there are a whole bunch of organizations that follow a similar philosophy, but they're not doing it the way Medicare wants you to do it. To me, that's fine. Why not find the system that works for you as a local health system rather than, necessarily following especially the initial ideas that the CMS had. CMS has loosened up its rules, but nonetheless, results have been less than promising. I would say that's partly because they started off on the wrong foot, partly because it's too early to know, and partly because this whole idea for the Medicare program was a way of getting people into organized health plans without them knowing they're in an organized health plan. And that strikes me as a very bizarre idea. We need to enlist the, I'm going to call patient, call him a patient, but he might also be a customer. We need to enlist that person in the struggle that we have in the health system to do a better job at a lower price.
So let's turn to the microphones.
Joyce Frieden from MedPage Today. A few people have touched briefly on the effect or lack thereof of the Affordable Care Act. So I just wanted to get back to that for a minute. Are people thinking it's too soon to tell whether the effect of the act or having more people have insurance is going to help mitigate health care costs, and what evidence might we be looking for later that would tell us whether it's having an effect?
Well, you look anxious. I am anxious to say that if you expand subsidies for health insurance, you should expect to spend more for health care. So that part of it isn't going to control, isn't going to help the health spending issue. It really is what everything else we've been talking about, changing the way healthcare is delivered. And with regard to the ACA, I do think it is too early. I'm a little skeptical a lot about some of the initiatives that have been undertaken. But nonetheless, let's see how they work out. The other point, though, that I would make is that the ACA and politicians in general have studiously avoided really reforming the Medicare program. And it seems to me that being the biggest purchaser, the biggest payer in the country, that really not take a fundamental look at fee-for-service Medicare and really ask ourselves, isn't there a better way to do it? And shouldn't we, instead of saying, oh, well, we've solved the physician payment problem because we haven't changed anything about the way physicians are paid, we have just eliminated the political pressure on Congress to do anything on the update factors. That's not reform. We need to take a look at Medicare. I'm concerned that we're going to take the easy way out and say, well, we solved that problem and not worry about it until the next crisis.
I would agree with absolutely everything Joe just said, but I would also say that when you ask that question, I would look less at what's actually in the ACA and more at the effect it may be having and has had on accelerating changes already underway in the marketplace. So if you're out there and you're, run a hospital or a group practice and you look at reductions coming down the line in future Medicare payments, or you look at the Medicare delivery and payment reform demonstrations, you see the writing on the wall. It's part of a writing that is already on the wall, changes already underway in the marketplace. I think there's good reason to believe it has accelerated changes which were already underway in the marketplace, but don't ask me to prove it to you.
So, Joe, I'm going to ask you to follow up. You mentioned Medicare, and of course, like other costs, the cost growth of Medicare has also been moderate over the last four or so years. At what point can we expect some return to this, to Medicare, as part of the policy discussion? Because there has been less talk lately, potentially because of the more moderate growth rates. So, but yet we have the aging of the population. We know that we have a lot more coming. So what do you see there?
So another reason why there's been less talk about Medicare is the very legitimate reason that we have focused so much on the uninsured. By definition, if you're in Medicare, you're not uninsured. And so that was a legitimate focus. There's just so much that people can spend time actively trying to resolve. Part of the issue here is that we do have the baby boom generation now coming into the Medicare program. By definition, when you turn 65, you're younger than, 20 years later. You're likely to be healthier. And in general, the baby boom generation moving in is, on average, probably healthier than certainly the Medicare beneficiaries who are, say, in their 70s and older. So to some extent, this slowdown in Medicare spending, I think to a small extent, is related to having Medicare become a younger program for a few years. Certainly in 6, 7, 8 years, that's going to reverse. The youngest baby boomers will be in their 70s. They will have gotten to be very familiar with their physicians. They probably will have had diagnoses that require some active medical treatment. So we're going to see a change there. As far as why the slowdown occurred in Medicare, it is the numbers are quite startling. To have Medicare spending growth on a per capita basis slower than the rest of health spending for a few years. But I don't think it's such a mystery. Seniors, contrary to CBO's working paper, seniors are affected by the economy. They haven't gotten a raise in Social Security. Their pension or other retirement payments have been pretty slow because of the recession, not because of anything else. And the slow recovery also affected them. So, in fact, I think part of this is that, speaking about some of my relatives, when they see something on TV, they say, well, gee, this could affect me. So I think we have seen a slowdown in spending, driven partially by that. It's also a slowdown in spending because of Part D. With the especially the movement of the biggest statin drugs to off-patent basis, the cost of treating cholesterol in the Medicare program has plummeted. And it's a very popular set of drugs to take, so that obviously has had a big contribution. Beyond that, though, I think we're going to see Medicare spending return to its more traditional growth rates, if only because some of the payment cuts that the ACA enacted, which are beginning to take effect, cuts to hospitals and to other payment healthcare providers in Medicare, those can become very, very difficult cuts to take politically. They accumulate. They can become quite large. And so a big factor here is what Congress does. If Congress decides that they need to slow down the cuts, then I think we're going to also see that's going to be another factor that will drive Medicare spending in the future.
Okay, so Joe, you have now opened the door to by talking about prescription drugs, for us to talk a little bit about prescription drugs, not just the ones that have gone down in price and cost for Medicare beneficiaries, but we've had several folks in the audience and via Twitter ask us about the cost of prescription drugs, both the increase in spending on generic medications and also specialty drugs. We have a very expensive drug on the market now for hepatitis C. There are a number of questions in this area, including price versus cost. How do you address the cost of specialty drugs, such as for MS or hepatitis C, without creating barriers to access? And how much do the prescription drugs play into the costs, and what do we need to see happen in this area? A lot of questions there. I think we could have another briefing on this.
Yeah, easily.
Okay, Gary?
Gary.
Just to do part of it, clearly the specialty drugs are one of the big concerns from payers, private payers and public payers. We have seen in employer programs, but also in some of the individual insurance market plans, tiered formularies, which put all of the specialty drugs into very high-cost tiers. People who use those drugs will end up at their out-of-pocket maximum very quickly. Public programs have some of the same problems, depending on how they're delivered. And it comes back a little bit to private payers have, in particular, have no leverage whatsoever over drugs that are necessary, have no true competitors or substitutes in them which are on patent. So those drugs are absolutely necessary for those patients, and there aren't alternatives in some of these cases, and they can charge what they want. The way that some insurers have chose to deal with it is to make the cost sharing as high as possible, which to some extent shares the cost, but also shames the pharmaceutical manufacturer to some extent, and then you get other programs coming the other way where the pharmaceutical manufacturers will subsidize people who can't afford it, and it all becomes very silly in some ways. But everyone is doing what meets their economic interest. Whether or not we're able to come in and say we want to do more in terms of regulating the prices, that's never been a place where we have been as a country. Whether we want to try to push insurers to not put high-cost drugs on that are necessary and have no substitutes on high cost-sharing tiers might sound like it's helping the patient, and it probably is, but those insurers really don't have any way to ameliorate those costs either. So that'll just end up in premiums, which may or may not be more fair. But the way this works out is not easy to deal with if you're not willing to go in and say something about what you think manufacturers should be able to charge for some of those drugs. The generic issues are completely different. But.
Do you want to say that? Well, just one thing. I agreed with everything that Gary says. I was involved in a meeting with various pharmaceutical manufacturers, and the question was asked, why aren't you oriented to those chronic diseases that generate what's called the highest disability adjusted life years, or DAILIES? Because that's where the biggest impact can be in terms of the health of the population. And the response was, there's too much risk. The price point is more competitive. The level of distribution to the population is much more challenging. The level of differentiation in terms of what we can manufacture in the drug is perhaps marginal, where with orphan drugs you have a much different set of circumstances that Gary just described. My hope is that there can be a convening of well-meaning experts to determine what type of regulations can be put together that will create a greater interest on the part of pharma to align their priorities to these diseases that generate the highest level of disability adjusted life year.
So as an expert, chills run down my spine whenever anybody says, let's convene a group of experts.
Uh-oh.
So, you know, the pharmaceutical market is extremely complicated. And it's very hard to to make generalizations that are actually correct. I really appreciated Marilyn's distinction between price versus cost. The price of, we don't need to name the names, but the price of the hepatitis C drug is very, very high, absolutely. Now, the question is it really $1,000 a pill? That's the first question. Has any insurance company actually paid $1,000 a pill? So we don't know the answer to that question. We do know that that's the list price. Second question, and this is the critical one, which is the cost. What is the cost of actually treating the patient as opposed to delivering one form of treatment or one aspect of treatment? So the older methodology, which apparently doesn't work very well, I don't know enough about the medicine here to be credible, but what I've read is that the older method of treating hepatitis C does not work very well. The percentages that I vaguely remember are not very good for cures, and it's painful treatment. It's very difficult for the patient. And it's also very expensive. So where did $100,000 come from, if that was the price, the list price? It was related to a judgment by the pharmaceutical company about the efficacy of their treatment versus the alternatives. the cost and the overall cost of the system, which gets to the real point. It's the overall cost of the system that we ought to be focusing on. And this again goes back to the fragmentation of the healthcare system. That said, we're treading here on very dangerous ground for the future. It's not just hepatitis C. It's that cure that I want for me 15 or 20 years from now. And I don't think we have the answer to that. It is certainly the case that in pharmaceutical investment in research is a major factor. It is certainly the case that pharmaceutical investment by NIH is very important as well. It is also the case that you have to have a market in order to encourage that kind of investment, unless you nationalize it. And if you nationalize it, then you run into questions about whether you are, at the same time, reducing the scope of research. So I think there are really difficult questions here. It's easy to say there are some bad guys here. It is certainly the case that some insurance companies are putting specialty drugs at the highest tiers. By the way, what's the reason? I think the main reason is to discourage people with those diseases from signing up for their coverage in the exchanges. When you limit what an insurance company can do to control cost, then you're going to get that kind of behavior, and that's what the ACA has done for the exchanges. So we need to look more broadly at this problem. It's difficult.
Okay, we have a question at the mic. Could you identify yourself, please?
Yes, Gary Feilerman. I'm on the board of AACME, the Accrediting Council on Continuing Medical Education. And it's through that lens I'm listening to hear what you have to say about changing provider behavior. They're not sitting in the Marshfield Clinic in Geisinger. There are three guys sitting upstairs at the drugstore writing their prescriptions on paper blanks. They don't have an EHR. And CME is the only tether we have to them. Because the hospital medical staffs aren't functioning as we assume they are or should or would. They've changed. So the only way we have of engaging this backbone of practice in the community is through the CME structure. And I don't hear anybody addressing the question of testing it, improving its efficacy, its reach, and bringing the physicians into more active engagement and participation in order to bring them along in everything you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Any response?
Well, Gary, you and I have talked about this, and I would say it's just got to be made more meaningful, more relevant. You and I have talked about just kind of studying for the test. In other words, get your credits, so licensure or board eligibility and the like. I would certainly agree that it is a channel, a distribution channel that we should more effectively utilize.
I have a question for Joe, mostly for Joe and Gary. So from my perspective, as we've been so focused on the ACA, there's been almost a revolution in health insurance from more to less comprehensive, especially with the tremendous and steady, and in the end, tremendous growth in deductibles. So the average deductible now is $1,400 for a single policy, $2,800 for a family, and the most commonly selected silver plan in the exchanges, it's $2,500 for a single policy. Those are high deductibles, higher cost sharing. And it brings me to the point, you know, we talk a lot about national health spending and healthcare costs in the budget. For me, it is also a people issue, or you could think of them that as your constituents. So for Joe, and I'd also like to get Gary's comment on this, do you view this as a good thing, a bad thing, a little bit of both? And then I'd like to see what Gary thinks.
Well, if you're a relatively low-income person, with a heavily subsidized premium on the exchange, but you're facing a $5,000 deductible, that's as good as being uninsured, as far as most people are concerned. Now, it is true that there is that sort of end of the line safety net that we have. If you put everything off, something really bad happens, you end up in the emergency room, the hospital will have to take care of you. You will end up either qualifying for Medicaid or, you know, something will happen. You might just be bad debt. But that's not exactly the image that we have for organized health insurance. That's not what we want. So we need to make some changes there. I mean, the enthusiasm that a lot of conservatives have, which I share, for high deductible health plans with health savings accounts is really an enthusiasm for those of us who ought to be in them. It's basically everybody in this room. People who have the money, they're middle class people, and they need a little nudge to remind them that everything isn't free and they ought to be sensible about what they're buying. But for low income people, we've got to recognize their circumstances, and we haven't solved that.
Thank you.
I guess I mean I wouldn't disagree with Joe. For the most part, as cost sharing has gone up, it does unfortunately look like people with lower incomes often have higher cost sharing than people with higher incomes, yes. Except by choice if they go into an HSA qualified plan or such. So we have some serious issues with people who have insurance being able to really effectively use it. We did a paper, which you can find on our website, which shows that a substantial shares of people don't have savings or liquid assets to actually pay the deductibles, much less the out-of-pocket maxes in their policies, and including families where everyone had private health insurance or private coverage. Private health insurance. So this is an issue we have to keep paying attention to over time. And one of the ways that the ACA addressed it, but to a minor extent, is that people who are lower income also can get cost-sharing subsidies. But that's certainly not everybody, and that's certainly not people who are lower income in employer plans who may be facing high cost-sharing.
Great. So before we take our last question or two, I want to remind you that you have a blue evaluation sheet in your packet, if you would kindly fill that out. And those of you who are congressional staffers, you were also handed a yellow survey that we would be happy to have back from you at the end of the briefing. So we have a question about how effective all payers' claims databases are in affecting prices and consumer behavior. What is the potential of these databases? And I think before anyone on the panel answers that question particularly, it would be good to have an explanation as to what that is.
Not me.
Gary, can you handle that?
At the state level, there are a couple states trying to collect information from payers about the transaction costs for at least hospitals and maybe some other types of care. There's some national things as well. Some of those are charges, which means that the information you get is almost useless in terms of price. It tells you something about the number of services. Whether or not, I've not looked closely. There's a couple small states that have tried to pull together some actual price information, and maybe Jeff can say more about this. I have downloaded it from one of the states, and it was daunting, and so I haven't explored it as much. But getting more information about price certainly lets people know where they stand, lets us understand more about what things actually cost, which is a good thing. It's not clear we know how to affect it, any of it other than by publicizing it, given the way we pay for health services. But it's certainly a move forward to better understanding what's going on.
I'm certainly no expert in this, which I think gives me credibility with you, Joe. Is that right?
Absolutely.
No expert in
Well,
this.
I think we need to form a committee.
Okay. But I just take what Gary has said. This is in very, very complex. I think there was a time when we thought, well, if we could just mass these
private sector payers with the public sector payers into one database, we'd have what we need. And clearly, it's only a step among many steps. As we look at the need for information, it's a high need. Performance, comparative performance on quality and cost is opaque in healthcare. It needs to be transparent. It's going to take a lot more work than just having access to data to make it usable so that providers can understand their relative performance to other providers as an incentive to improve. Payers can see provider performance per condition or procedure, and a lot of that needs to be bundled in terms of hospital and multiple physicians involved in that care. And patients also need to know, especially now that they're incentivized with high deductibles and copays, what the comparative cost is, and I would submit very important to also know comparative quality. So I would say it's a step in the right direction, but there's many more steps that have to be undertaken.
Okay, so this will be our last question. And we talked a little earlier about the high cost of waste in the system. And, of course, fraud is a big part of that. So if we have the question is what role healthcare fraud and Medicare fraud have in influencing costs, and how can we reduce fraud? I think that's probably easier said than done.
Gary?
I guess I would probably disagree with one of the things you said, which was if we were talking about waste being as, you know, multiple percentage points of healthcare spending, I'm not sure fraud is a big part of that. I think it's millions of dollars whenever you do a report, or tens of millions of dollars, which is important, and it sends bad signals, and it doesn't, and it reduces people's confidence in programs, public programs, private programs, and it often can result in people being poorly treated as well. But compared to $2.9 trillion, it's not a big part of that.
Okay, so we're going to wrap up here. Please join me in thanking our panelists for a discussion that I think will continue throughout for a long time to come.
You know what it is.
I know what it is.
They tend to.